All right, everyone. Episode 31 of the Wake Up Podcast. This is part two of the Scott Horton series of episodes. We didn't have enough time to go through everything that we wanted to go through last time because obviously the state and all of the stupidity that it's, you know, enacting on the world is endless. So, you know, as a result, we can talk for an endless amount of hours describing all of that. But Scott was kind enough to come on again within the space of a week. And on this one, you know, we discussed obviously how the poor and the lack of defining terms has sort of spread into society, and, you know, everyone that has a differing opinion to what the mainstream might want us to have is now labeled a terrorist or a bigot or some other, you know, ridiculous idea or ridiculous label. But more than that, we talked about in this episode, I really wanted to push Scott on Bitcoin as a functional, real, practical solution to the problem that is the state. And the way Bitcoin is a solution to this is it demonopolizes money, money being the most important invention and resource for society. And the fact that the state can print its own money gives it the ability to run a deficit and effectively run a bankrupt institution that operates on the basis of moral hazard. Like, they can do whatever they want, and we effectively pay for it through the evaporation of the purchasing power of our money and through the theft that is taxation. So I really enjoyed this episode. I think me and Scott, you know, it wasn't so much of just the, you know, one-way conversation. It was a good two-way discussion. And I think anyone who is still questioning Bitcoin, you know, particularly anyone who's a libertarian who's still trying to understand this, I hope that this episode helps you get beyond the fact that it's some technical, you know, internet funny money, and sort of really understand the philosophy first. Because if you start with Bitcoin from a philosophy first position, you can then go down the rabbit hole and try and understand technically how it works. But it really starts with understanding its raison d'etre. So again, hope you enjoy this episode. This is episode 31. Subscribe, share it around, follow Scott and the work that he's doing, not only at antiwar.com, but the Libertarian Institute, his new book, Enough Already, and tag this podcast, share it around, and also tag Dave Smith, comic Dave Smith on Twitter, because I'd love to get him on the show to really start to get libertarians around Bitcoin, because I think that's such an important group of people who are obviously intelligent, who get it, that need to get on the bandwagon or get on the Bitcoin bandwagon as soon as possible. So thank you again for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode. And we're live with episode 31 of the Wake Up Podcast, and I've got Scott Horton back. It's only been a week, but here we are doing part two because we didn't have enough time to finish the conversation last time. And there's a whole lot of things I want to ask, and I'm actually going to get stuck into it. So first of all, thanks for agreeing to come on again, Scott. I know,
happy to
know
be
you're
here.
A busy man. So look, let's get stuck into this. So since we spoke last week, couple of weird things I've seen pop up. And I mean, I haven't even looked into any of this stuff yet, but I'm just curious to see if you've got any comments on. One is all of this, I guess, derangement syndrome that we're seeing with people like, I mean, most recently now, I think the Proud Boys have been considered, or they're now officially a domestic terrorist organization in Canada and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Have you heard any of this?
Yeah, I mean, I just saw the headline about it last night, and made my little point about it on Twitter that you see how dangerous this is. It's the partisanship, man, that mm-hmm. nobody wants their side to be labeled terrorist. But you have, at the same time that that happened to the right wing in Canada, which might as well have been in one American state or the other, as far as that goes, could be an American state any day now. Wouldn't surprise us if somebody tried to say that in the law, designate them as such in the law. But mm-hmm. in Seattle, a bunch of leftist protesters occupied a motel and filled it with homeless people, you know, newly homeless because the government forced them out of their job, right? It's not even the wilds of the quasi-free market. It's outright, you know, government restrictions on economic behaviors created an entire new class of homeless people. And so they occupied this hotel and filled it, you know, with American civilians, you know? And what they did is they sent in the SWAT team, and the mayor, I'm almost certain this was, you know, I forgot what town it was. I was going to say Seattle, but that's not right. It was one of these towns, Portland, Oregon or something. Help me out, man. I'm not Googling. There's one of these towns out on the left coast, Northwest, last night. They're occupying a motel, and the mayor said that they're domestic terrorists. And these are, you know, essentially like, you know, food, not bombs type left wing, you know, anarchist types. And so
one day keep going. It's the Red Lion Inn Hotel.
I'm sorry?
Red Lion Inn Hotel.
Yes, I think so. Yeah. And they sent in the SWAT team to roust them all out of there. You seen that? What town is that?
It's in
I'm not very good at telling this story, am I?
No, you're doing great, because I didn't even, Olympia City officials, so wherever the hell Olympia City is.
Yeah. Okay, so it was the mayor of that town. I think that's in Washington. And it was the mayor of the town said, yeah, see, they're domestic terrorists. Well, come on, no, they're not, right? Like, they're trespassing. They're political activists, and they might say, you know, commie slogans out loud about how they disrespect your right to property or whatever kind of black bloc thing they might have to say. But what the hell makes them domestic terrorists? Nothing. Nothing. Same thing for the Proud Boys. In fact, in the article last night, it said, well, they're known for their racist rhetoric. Well, you know what? Like, as far as I know, I don't think, and I really don't know a lot about the modern day radical right. I have not spent a lot of time studying this stuff, but I think they are not very radical. I mean, they've been involved in some brawls and that kind of thing, but I don't think that this is, you know, a direct comparison to the Aryan Nations or something like that. I think they're probably two or three clicks to the left of real Nazis, you know, and are more like a social club of kind of, you know, anyway, I don't know exactly how dangerous they are, but I know they're not domestic terrorists. And the thing is, that was what how they qualified. They said, well, they have racist rhetoric. But here's the point. Terrorism means something. Nobody ever defines it very well, but sometimes you can find a strict enough definition. But terrorism means using violence or extremely credible threats of violence, right? Like, say, setting off a bomb, but calling it in first, but didn't have to, right? Like that kind of thing. Extreme violence or threats of violence against innocent civilians in order to provoke a political reaction of one kind or the other, right? That's what terrorism is, which means that if right-wingers and left-wingers get into a big fist fight in the street, that's not terrorism. And if right wingers say, well, we don't like this or that kind of ethnic group being around us, that's not terrorism. And if left wingers occupy somebody's private property to fill it with homeless people, that's not terrorism. These things are whatever they are, but terrorism they're not, right? And, you know, they do this. I remember right after September 11th, a guy went into a place and shot it up with a handgun. And the prosecutor tried to charge him with the use of a weapon of mass destruction. Well, come on. You know, we joke, you know, libertarians and right-wingers like to joke about how left-wingers have taken the word assault rifle, which means fully automatic rifle, and weasel-worded that to assault weapon, which means a hunting rifle but with a pistol grip or whatever they want it, right? A scary-looking gun. Even if it's actually just a semi-automatic rifle, but it's one that they're afraid of, you know, they're essentially stretching definitions to get away with calling something what it's not. Well, weapons of mass destruction means chemical weapons, biological weapons, or nuclear weapons, right? America drops a 1,000-pound bomb on an apartment building and we go, nah, that's a precision strike.
Yeah.
But if somebody our government doesn't like uses a handgun, they'll say, Your Honor, he's violating the weapons of mass destruction statute because he shot four people. And they'll try to get away with that if they can't. And so same thing with anything. If you, you know, the new law that they're proposing, which I'm not sure if it's actually been introduced yet, but the new law, the new domestic terrorism law that they're proposing, the first thing that it does is create a new domestic terrorism agency inside the Department of Homeland Security and inside the FBI. Right.
Just so what we need.
Institutionalized permanently the PATCON operation of the 1990s for the federal cops to infiltrate the radical right to make them worse in order to scapegoat them and try to marginalize them. That's their brilliant counterinsurgency type program, you know, like the P2OG type Pentagon approach under Donald Rumsfeld, you know. Infiltrate groups, make them worse in order to discredit them and marginalize them. And we see how effective that is. All they've done is make the war on terrorism worse everywhere they go. I don't know if you saw where Robert Grenier, who was the head of the Counterterrorism Center and was the station chief in Islamabad during, you know, 2001, at the time of the beginning of the war on terrorism and everything. And he went on NPR News and said, we have to use our counterinsurgency doctrine against the American right. And then it's funny, man, you know, in both books, I kind of go on. And I try to make a point about this because it really bothers me that I really think that they let bin Laden go deliberately, that they conflated Al-Qaeda and the Taliban as much as they could. And then they took their fight to the Taliban and gave only limited resources to the fight against Al-Qaeda while letting them go. Well, Robert Grenier, in this interview with NPR News last week, he says in that interview, it's like a Freudian slip kind of thing. Like he just starts talking and then starts making admissions. What I think are admissions of severe guilt. He says, listen, when we went to war in Afghanistan in 2001, he says, there were hardly any Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. As I write in my book, only 400 men. There were hardly any Al-Qaeda there. And so, yes, we took our fight to Al-Qaeda, but primarily, direct quote, bro, primarily we went after the Taliban, the environment, or we went after the environment in which they were flourishing. And that means the Taliban. So with me, I'm such a literalist on this. I'm going, aha, see, he's admitting right then and there that they decided, even while the smoke is still coming out of the tower, the rubble in downtown Manhattan, that they're going to go ahead and let bin Laden go and focus on Mullah Omar, who didn't knock the towers down. Because rather than focusing on the guilty, they would rather focus on the environment in which they were flourishing. Yeah. In other words, under the Taliban regime that Bill Clinton had helped install in power just 5 years before. But anyway, see, here's the point. I get distracted. That's not the point. The point is Robert Grenier's metaphor. What the hell is he talking about? He's talking about this ridiculous mob, this half of a farce of a thing that happened at the Capitol on January 6th, that this represents the core of Al-Qaeda terrorists. This is the van. We're supposed to just believe that all these middle class QAnon dum-dums, basically, that showed up, middle class, middle-aged dum-dums, I should say, who showed up at that thing. They're all the vanguard of America's neo-Nazi movement, really? And they're pretty in the pathetic thrall, as he puts it, of President Donald Trump. He compares Donald Trump to Saddam Hussein and said he is the leader of this insurgency. Insurgency? What insurgency? They said that the right wing was going to show up at every state capitol on Inauguration Day and seize the Capitol buildings and hold them hostage and prevent the inauguration of Biden and all this. Nothing happened. One protester showed up in New York State. One, you know, and that was it. I mean, there was nothing across the entire country, nothing. And then so here's the point, though, is he's saying, look, first of all, just pretend that the people at the Capitol building were all a bunch of Timothy McVeighs. Just pretend to believe that. And then, secondly, then, that means that the entire American populist right, if the guys at the Capitol are Al-Qaeda, then the entire populist right are the Taliban. And Grenier, after 20 years, is telling us how smart they were to go after the Taliban instead of Al-Qaeda. And he's saying, that's what we need to do now. We need to go after the broad populist right kind of movement, the right wing of the Republican Party, the territory in which these radicals thrive, in order to somehow, you know, instead of just arresting people who actually committed a crime, which is their mandate.
How dumb are these people though? But like, see, this is what I can't understand is what's the achievement? Like, what do you gain by taking these people? Granted, some might be a couple nut jobs. I would argue that a lot of the people who so-called stormed the fucking Capitol, you know, were probably, you know, there would have been a fair share of actors in there who were just going there to instigate, to make somebody else look bad. So I think it's too, muddled up. But like, what is a clown like the one you just mentioned? What's his outcome? Why would you go and try and frame half of the population of the country you're supposedly meant to serve as terrorists? Like, what the fuck do you gain by doing that? I can understand going, I mean, I can't understand, but, you know, one could make an argument of, you know, framing all the Arabs as terrorists so, you know, they can justify this state of war so they can go and rape and pillage and do whatever the fuck they're doing that. But how the fuck does that serve them doing it internally? I just don't. Can you enlighten me here, perhaps?
I mean, I don't know. If the Democrats, it makes perfect sense for the Democrats, of course, to pretend that everyone on the right half of the American population are all a bunch of anti-government traitor terrorists, you know, Southerners in the Civil War and whatever, and they're the only true patriots. That makes sense. For the FBI and the police agencies, I mean, they have very narrow interests, such as getting promotions for themselves and making more money and these kinds of things. If there's, you know, it's almost comforting to think that like somewhere there's a committee of men who are not self-interested, but are just trying to do the right thing for the country somehow, who would be wise enough to say that, you know what, the radical right is already radical enough as it is, and infiltrating it with a bunch of feds to make it worse is almost certainly a bad idea that's only going to backfire and be counterproductive and get innocent people hurt and all kinds of things, as has happened in the past, such as the case in the Oklahoma bombing. And so, you know, let's not do this. But I don't think there is a wise man. I don't think there's an oak table where there's a... did you ever see the movie? I think it's the movie Conspiracy Theory with Mel Gibson, where Jean-Luc Picard is torturing him and he's an MKUltra subject and all of this stuff. But at the end of the movie, there's this black guy in a suit who he explains how he represents this federal agency that you've never heard of, that's above the CIA and above the FBI and above everyone else. And they're the real grown-ups. And they make sure that even though these things are bad and get out of control, ultimately the very tippy top conspiracy are a bunch of very wise, responsible gentlemen. And thank goodness for that. But that's just not
only in Hollywood.
It's a free
only in Hollywood.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, that's where I think, this is where I think a lot of the conspiracy theory things fall over, is that a lot of this stuff I don't think is very well planned. I think a lot of this stuff is just incompetent morons who think that they can somehow manage complex systems from the center. And all they're doing is in this, like you said, free for all kind of, you know, grabbing for personal power. It's just this complete fuck up and chaos where definitions are thrown out the window. Morals become completely relative. Everything becomes whose narrative is, you know, more compelling and who screams louder. Like I think, I don't know, I've just seen some tweets today about AOC saying like how terrified she was at the storming the Capitol, but she wasn't even there or something. Like, what the fuck is going on?
Well, I'll tell you, this, man. There's three or four sources for this, that in 1996, right after winning the re-election campaign in 1996, Bill Clinton on Air Force One, I guess, talking with the press on the tarmac, said to them, you know, the Oklahoma City bombing saved my presidency. So that people rallied around the flag and rallied around the leader against the domestic enemy. And he just couldn't help but gloat that, you know, man, it sure is good for business when the radical right goes too far, isn't it? And, you know, I brought this up. I got to bring it up, elaborate just a little bit. We don't have to do a whole thing or anything, but people should know there's a lot more to that Oklahoma bombing story than just McVeigh did it. And, you know, the Occam's razor explanation to try to simplify it as simple as possible is that it was a PATCON, that's short for Patriot Conspiracy, was the name of the FBI operation where they were infiltrating the radical right. And that this was part of that. And it was a sting operation that got out of control. And the guys who were being stung went ahead and got away with the bombing anyway. But it's actually fair. It's not truth or craziness. It's fair to, you know, at least hold as a strong possibility that it was deliberately provoked in the first place by an agent provocateur named André Strassmeier, who was not really a Nazi at all, but was a German army intelligence officer, essentially on loan to the US government, who had infiltrated this group of right-wingers in the American South, in Oklahoma, in the Ozark area there, and in the far east of Oklahoma. And these are the guys who did it. And the reason that they got away with it was because they were all undercover informants or flip state's witnesses, or, you know, in one way or the other, they were compromised by the feds, but they compromised the feds right back. And so when they got away with the attack, it was easier to just blame it on the one guy. And of course, the one guy wanted to take credit for it too. And so they just covered it up, and they let probably 10 guys get away with killing 168 people just to protect the FBI. And they admit it. I mean, this is not truth or crap. This is serious stuff. If anyone goes to libertarianinstitute.org/OKC, there's this brilliant researcher and author. He's working on a book now. His name is Richard Booth. I mean, he's not any kind of kook at all. And yes, there are kooks who are interested in this subject as well, but he's not one of them. And he's put together this incredible archive of all the best journalism and all of the best primary source documents, court documents, FBI, CIA, Secret Service, ATF, and local police, and whatever you got. All of the best stuff in the world on Oklahoma City is there for people to look at. And again, all the best magazine articles and that kind of thing that really sum up and tell the story. So, you know, I think that's what I would expect from creating a new counterterrorism, counter domestic terrorism department in the FBI would be more Oklahoma cities. That, oh, I know what we'll do. We'll send our Strassmeiers in to get these Nazis to do something stupid. And then I expect the Nazis to outsmart the cops and get away with their horrible thing, just like what happened last time.
Yeah.
And by the way, look what they did last time. Look how, when Bill Clinton says it saved my presidency, how's that? It's because his government blamed the Oklahoma City bombing on the entire right wing of America at the time. They blamed it on Rush Limbaugh, who is essentially just a Republican, right? He is center right, country club, conservative Republican. And according to Bill Clinton, Rush Limbaugh did it, and every other white man with a gun in America slaughtered those babies at Oklahoma City. That's who Republicans are. And it was just, it was insane. And then the actual guilty, they let a bunch of neo-Nazis go free. And then what did they do to McVeigh? They whitewashed McVeigh. They said McVeigh's not a Nazi. McVeigh was a militia guy, even though that wasn't true. He'd shown up at Michigan militia meetings and they'd thrown him out. This guy's a Nazi, get rid of him. Well, and then what they do? They said, never mind the actual role of the Nazis who did it. Let's pretend that the entire populist radical right in America, and hell, for that matter, the conservative center right in America, that they're all a bunch of Nazis, especially the militias, are all Nazis. Even though the militias weren't Nazis. If the militias were Nazis, they'd have been Nazis, not militias. That says it right there, you know? And so they let the actual Nazis get away with it while smearing the entire right wing for something that they didn't do. The same way that they smeared every Arab or every Muslim between Nigeria and the Philippines for an attack by one small handful of Egyptians and Saudis.
It's Yeah, I there was one of the questions I wanted to ask you on the other prior podcast was, you know, how warfare has changed, particularly in 2020. But you know, looking at or understanding better how, you know, what history's looked like over the last 20, 30, 40 years, it's something that's obviously been building up to this type of crescendo. And bear with me for a second as I frame this. So, you know, if we look at, I'm looking at a document here, which is the core values of a particular group. And tell me if there's anything here you really disagree with. So minimal government, maximum freedom, anti-political correctness, anti-drug war, closed borders, anti-racial guilt, anti-racism, pro-free speech, pro-gun rights, glorifying the entrepreneur, venerating the housewife, and reinstating the spirit of Western chauvinism. Is there anything there that you strongly disagree with, or, you know,
yes, all
by
the
and large, is it?
Yeah, all the right-wing garbage in there. All the role
which
for
the
state
in
making society, kicking out all the brown people, closing the borders, telling wives what to do was in there or something. Give me a break. What is that crap? Where'd you get that?
Well, no, okay. So define venerating the housewife. What does that mean to you?
That, what the hell does that have to do with a political platform of anything? Or what are we even talking about? You want to tell me what group we're talking about?
Well, this is the Proud Boys' core values.
Okay.
So,
well,
so what I'm trying to bring up here, I guess, is that things like anti-drug war, anti-political correctness, maximum freedom, minimal government.
I mean, I should say the parts of those things where they're talking about policies, like they're against the drug war. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. If they're saying they love housewives a lot, then that's fine too. If housewives are part of their political platform, then I don't know what they're talking about. So it seems, you know, it's like Newt Gingrich's contract with America. But the first half makes sense. The second half is, I don't know what the hell you're talking about anymore. So, you know, but I'm not a right winger. Sounds like that's, you know, there's a lot there for right wingers to like.
I guess
am not hung up on the hobby horse of crying all day about the wokists. Like, to me, the wokists are just a bunch of silly crybabies, and I don't give a damn what they say. But I don't spend a moment worrying about that crap. Any more than I spend a moment worrying about AOC. You know, I didn't even know this. I only realized it when it happened. That just last week was the first time I even heard her voice when she was talking about I don't remember what. And it was funny. It was the same thing as when the first time I heard Ben Shapiro. I just started laughing. Like, are you kidding me? That's her voice? She sounds like a ridiculous little girl, right? She doesn't sound like an intelligent person at all. She sounds like a stupid little kid. And so, what has she ever talked about other than herself? What effect? She proposed a Green New Deal or whatever. You guys can fight about that. I'm against it, obviously, but I just don't care about crap like that. Tell me when she is part of a discussion that's meaningful about anything that's meaningful. Otherwise, this is just TV show bullshit, right? I mean, I'm sorry, can I cuss on here?
No, keep going.
I see people going back and forth and back and forth about this woman. I ain't seen a substantive part of any of it yet. And so I just don't care about that. You know what I mean?
There is going to be no substantive part. I guess it's impossible to have substance in, you know, like there's a saying I like, which is this idea of, you know, you've got, it's not how good the train driver is, it's the direction that the train tracks have been laid. You know, so if the train tracks are laid off the side of a fucking cliff, it doesn't matter if you go off fast or slow, you're going off the edge of the cliff. So I think
if she's not even the chair of a committee or anything, right? I mean, she doesn't have any power. I'm much more interested in whether Joe Biden is going to keep Milley as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. What the hell do I care who's a congressman from New York? I don't care.
So I guess coming back to my original point is this idea of how warfare has potentially changed. So politicking has been around, you know, since the dawn of time, and people blaming each other for shit they didn't do just so they can gain some sort of strength. But I guess, you know, in the modern age where potentially the fact that any idiot can push, or not any idiot, but a few idiots can push a red button and blow us all up, you know, has maybe created some, you know, level of Mexican standoff or deterrence such that, you know, warfare is almost transformed into what we're seeing in the last 12 months of things like lockdowns, things like ridiculous mask mandates, things like, you know, curfews, and effectively what's effectively martial war for all of us. Like, do you think that And now also this ability to fucking label anybody you want as a terrorist. Like, do you think that, you know, does that mean anything, you know, to you? Like, has warfare evolved into something more covert than it was in the past, because you can't just go and shoot someone now, because it'll go all over social media? And do you think other tactics are being employed to keep a state of emergency going? Because we sort of established in the last thing that warfare is kind of like the state validates its position as the caretaker through constantly being at war so they can justify anything. So do you think their mechanism for justifying a state of emergency is transforming into these stupid fucking lockdowns and for your safety and all this sort of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, that all makes sense. In a sense, I mean, it's funny because the war, I mean, we shouldn't really just conflate these terms too much, because living in a totalitarian police state really sucks, but also it's different than sending your infantry into somebody else's country and shooting them all and dropping bombs on them and all this, which America does. And we are at war in these other countries. But you're right. And I forget, I'm sorry, because I've done a lot of interviews lately and I forget what all we talked about, you know, last time, but you're right that, you know, really because of the advent of the atom bomb, the major powers don't fight anymore. So now they just fight these proxy wars or just take out their aggression or empty and refill their inventories on the heads of people in third world countries who can't resist and this kind of thing. But even in that sense, that, you know, the wars have gotten much less violent. I mean, it's absolutely horrible and I'm against all of it and just wrote a book about it and all that. But we've had, you know, approximately 10 or 20 something thousand civilian deaths in Afghanistan each year over the past few years anyway, right around that. So that's a lot, but our government could kill that many people in one day if they were trying, right? And so that what they're doing is wrong. I'm not justifying it, but I'm just saying if they decided to just decimate the Kandahar province and take revenge on their enemies that way, they could do that. They've got B-52s, even without nukes. They could absolutely, you know, the Russians killed almost 1 million Afghans. The Russians were like, oh yeah, and just carpet bomb villages off the face of the earth, one after the other, after the other, after the other for 10 years, you know, 8 years. So America hasn't done that. It's been really bad, but it could have been a lot worse. Baghdad still stands. No Sunnis left there. You know, it's been a disaster, but they didn't actually shock and awe the whole place to the ground, literally, only figuratively. So, but then, yeah, like you say, war is the health of the state. That's Randolph Bourne's great piece that he wrote during World War One. Is about how, yeah, it's a thoughtful piece. I probably won't sum it up very well, but it's not just that war is the health of the government, but war is the health of the state, in the sense of the people all kind of, you know, turning and shedding their individual identities and identifying with the state and its power and rallying around it as the great defender and all these things. And, you know, a lot of this is at the core of the neoconservatives doctrine, as well as, I guess, everybody else in DC. But they're very explicit about this, that they're not right, you know, enlightenment people. They don't believe in the liberty of and the reason of the average guy. They think that we need these powerful myths to forge national greatness. Everyone should be forced. If we can't all be forced to believe in one religion together, then we should be forced to all believe in one big war together or one big project or another. And especially as you're indicating, you know, excising the demons from among us and all of this and making it seem necessary. And of course, I mean, it's easy to predict, right? You and I could have this conversation in 2 years and we'll be like, yeah, see how they provoke such a bad radical, you know, reaction from the radical right and these bad things that have happened, and how now the government and all the liberals on their side in the argument say, see how bad the radical right is, that they've done these terrible things in reaction to their own program. It's easy to see. It's, you know, it's just the same thing as the fight pick with the Russians. I'm actually paraphrasing from George Kennan talking about expanding NATO, see what's going to happen here. You're going to expand NATO right up to Russia's borders. And as soon as Russia reacts negatively, they're going to say, see, the Russians are a bunch of madmen, and that's why we have to do this in the first place. Same story, different day, man.
So, okay. So then that brings me into my next point, which is I was listening to you and Dave Smith on a podcast. I can't remember if he was on yours or you were on his or something. And you guys were talking about the difference between speaking to existing libertarians and normal people and how the hell do we jolt the asleep awake? Because, you know, I guess people like you and I can have this conversation, just like you said, you know, in 2 years' time, we're going to have the conversation. We can see like, well, this was fucking evident that we would get here, but surprise, surprise, we got here. But to somebody else, like you go and talk to somebody else on the street and that, you know, that they're sort of stuck in this paradigm that, you know, no, the government will figure it out. Like we need these large institutions to figure it out. So how do you go about trying to slap some sense, or have you just given up, you know, trying to awaken people? Like what do you think we do here to communicate a message? Cause you know, the libertarian parties tried and failed. Like, you know, there's all this stuff, but like, how? Help me.
Well, I mean, this is probably not a very satisfactory answer, right? But basically the deal is it's a war of social psychology. You know, sorry, bit my cheek there. It's a war of social psychology. So this is a easy example and not a very thoughtful one or whatever, but the idea essentially since Vietnam, and in fact, this may have changed, right? I may be speaking for 20 years ago, but the narrative has been that to be anti-war is the province of Jane Fonda and Janis Joplin and tie-dye and day glow and 1967 hippie stuff. And if not that, then maybe Michael Moore, the big fat communist hypocrite, blowhard, idiot, Hillary Clinton supporter, right? So there's nothing for anybody to identify with there, right? And what percentage of Americans now copy the style really of bell bottoms and tie dye and whatever. That's a niche of a style that no one else can relate to, right? But if you can say, for example, if Tucker Carlson brings Colonel Douglas McGregor on and says, hey, Colonel, isn't it right that you're the toughest SOB the east side of the Mississippi River? And the Colonel says, yeah, that's right. And I'd like to see anybody try it. And then Tucker says, hey, isn't it right that we don't have to fight like this because it's stupid, right? And the Ayatollah, we don't like him, but we're not afraid of him, are we, Colonel? And the Colonel goes, that's right, Tucker. Nobody cares about the Ayatollah. We can have peace because peace is easy and there are no threats and it's just fine and I say so. Well, then that's entirely different, right? And it cuts the legs out from under the preconceived notion that only a bunch of hippies who would be no good in a fight anyway are anti-war. In fact, here's a guy who's the toughest SOB east of the Mississippi River, the hero of the Great Tank Battle of Iraq War I, the guy who designed America's plan for war with Russia if we ever do get into one. And he's saying, we don't have any enemies. We don't have to fight. It doesn't have to be this way. And now your right-wing Uncle Bob hopefully will be a little bit more receptive to listening to an argument like that from a guy like that, you know? So that's the Horton rule, is for libertarians to attack the left from the left and the right from the right. Because whatever the left is good on, we're better. And whatever the right is good on, we're better. So, you know, you don't have to move to the right or pose as a right winger or be anything that you're not. The fact that you are a libertarian means that you are better on laissez-faire, free markets, property rights, the gold standard, the income tax, everything about capitalist economics than any right winger that you're dealing with. So start there. Mr. Right Winger, we agree on all these things, right? And you got to have hard money, right? And we want anybody who's ever worked for the IRS to be exiled and have to go live in French Canada or something, right? Like we're totally eye to eye here, right? Well, you know, you can't have hard money and no income tax as long as you maintain a world empire. You have to abandon the militarism. You have to give up the project of global dominance, or not only can you not have a free market, but you're going to have a horrible boom and bust cycle, paper money system like we've had, which pushes the population further and further, further and further away from free markets, because TV always gives the blame to the freedom in the market for whatever the problem is. So people move further and further to socialism and further to nationalism and you know, trade restrictions and all of this stuff, when what we need is free markets. And so then same thing with the leftists, that say, for example, you want to deal with the issue of gun control. Here's something where people on the left and liberals especially almost uniformly bad. But the thing is, if you're a good libertarian, you don't have to move left. You don't have to pretend like you're something you're not. You don't have to take a position different than what you really believe to talk with a leftist about criminal justice, about the school to prison pipeline, about the absolute corruption of the war on drugs and the persecution of poor people and especially minorities under the war on contraband. Like, we didn't learn this lesson from prohibition back in the days of Harding and Roosevelt. This is crazy. And, but then once you're on board and in total agreement and you've discussed the economics of drug prohibition and how the harder you crack down on it, the higher the price goes, the more the incentive for new people to enter the market to provide those things. And economics just insists, economics declares that wars on drugs will not stop drugs, man. They just can't. Higher prices means more supply, and around the circle it goes forever. You can't do it. And then you go, look, man, it's the same thing with guns. Look who gets prosecuted for having a gun. Poor people, and especially ethnic minorities, Blacks and Mexicans. They're in jail, in prison, not for robbing a store, but for having a gun. And liberals and left-wingers just somehow pretend they have it in their head. Just like right-wingers believe that only hippies are anti-war, left-wingers believe that only right-wing white guys own guns. But that's not true. And when it comes to gun control, it's not, well, sometimes it is. But by and large, it's not the people they'd like to see persecuted being persecuted. It's poor Black people who are being persecuted and prosecuted and literally imprisoned away from their families for simply having a gun in violation of some edict that says that it's an offense to possess one under whatever circumstances. In America, the land of the gun. In America, the land of the Second Amendment, where everybody carries guns. Everybody has guns. And so if you explain to a leftist, not as a right winger, I like guns. You can't have them, pussy. But hey, man, you say that you care about Black people and civil rights. You care about the police state. You care about people being in prison when they didn't really do anything. We have to legalize guns, man. The war on guns doesn't make any more sense than the war on drugs. Sorry, that's just the way it is. And yes, there are negative externalities, such as when guns are widely available, people murder each other with them a lot. Like, if you include suicides, it's, you know, 12,000 a year in this country or something like that. You know what it is? I read this great article about this. A lady who covered gun murders, gun crimes, on the nationwide basis for like 3 years for her newspaper. And she said, almost all of them is people get drunk on the weekends and kill their wife or their next door neighbor. That's almost all gun crime in America, right? It's not organized crime like in the movies. And it's not Black gangsters fighting over drug territory. It's people of all colors and descriptions getting drunk and killing people they care about with them. It's almost all gun crime in America, you know? And that does suck. And you know what? People overdosing and dying of heroin sucks too. And people burning their entire personality out on cocaine and destroying their family and destroying their business and destroying their lives is also a negative externality. But it's a hell of a lot less negative than trying to prohibit it and wage a war of government prohibition against it. And so those are the breaks. You got to take them, because trying to get government to intervene and make it the other way, it just doesn't work. So, I mean, that's my advice. It's how to win friends and influence people, man. You don't tell them they're wrong. You tell them they're right. You agree with them as much as you can. And then you just ask for a little consistency. If you really believe what you believe, then you have to agree with me on this, right? And that works well. And you know, here's the proof that that works well is some significant percentage of my audience are veterans of the Iraq and Afghan wars. And I didn't come at them going, "Wah, we need that money for government schools. Wah, you're a baby killer. And wah, a bunch of, you know, wear more tie dye." You know, that's not what they heard. And so they were willing to listen.
That was one of the best explanations. I know you framed it at the beginning as being potentially inadequate, but that was really spot on. I think the fact that libertarians get the nuance from both sides and are consistent across the principles that both sides supposedly believe in, I think that really does speak to the heart of how to actually speak to these people. I mean, in saying that though, like it's always easier said than done, because sometimes, you know, some people that you speak to don't want to be consistent. I can't tell you the amount of people that I've spoken to. It's like, it's ridiculous, but that was really good. That was really, really good.
What's the Horton rule? That's what Michael Bolden called it. I didn't name it that. Michael Bolden at the 10th Amendment Center named it that. And I learned it from driving a cab. Because I drove a cab for like 8 years and I've always been like this, you know? And so if I'm dealing with a rich, white, business owning Christian from the west side of town, that's different than dealing with a little old black Christian lady from the east side of town. You know, they're just different. And so we talk about what's interesting to them and what they care about and then see if I can get them. Because, you know, for me, I didn't know what a libertarian was until I knew what a libertarian was. In fact, I think the first time I saw the word, I still remember it was on the back of some beat old brown Oldsmobile, and the bumper sticker said, "Enough is enough. Vote libertarian." So I didn't know it was a political ideology. I just realized, oh, I get it. It's one of these little third parties. It's the Libertarian Party. But then I didn't even know what it was. Like, oh, okay. Like, white business guys for legalizing drugs and gay marriage. That's interesting. Like, all right. Okay. You know, I'm willing to take a look at this stuff, you know? Guys who look like Republicans who are anti-imperialists like communists. Huh. All right. I like that. You got to give people a chance to see, you know, and honestly, the way I believe is that libertarianism is true Americanism. I mean, if there's such a thing as Americanism at all, it's the one sentence in the Declaration of Independence that says, to us, this is what we all agree on. We think that we're born free and we can't prove it and we're not going to try to prove it, but screw you. If you don't like it, we'll shoot you. And that's what it says right there at the beginning. So, and that's the one thing that we all supposedly agree on, right? Is the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights, if not the rest of the Constitution, that this is what we're about. So then if that's right, then that's libertarianism essentially right there. Natural rights is step one. And then the rest of all of everything else we believe in flows from exactly that same set of premises, right? So then that means that all liberalism and all conservatism and all socialism and all kind of nationalism and populism and different kinds of puritanism and whatever different isms in America, a lot of those really then are deviations from the plumb line, the plumb line as set by Jefferson in that document there. And so as if libertarians are holders of the plumb line and the true heritage and tradition of American freedom, then all we're asking the liberals and conservatives to do, we don't have to condemn them. I mean, certain circumstances we do, but all we're asking really of them is to stay true to what we all say we believe in, right? I'm not coming at you with some weird, you know, tri-Hegelian, Marxian, Foucaultian, some weird thing from some faraway continent, man. This is plain old basic USA Declaration of Independence. This is what we believe in. Live and let live. That's it. And it works. And the reason we're all fighting so much and the reason we all hate each other so much is because we gave up, the liberals and the conservative deviationists, the right and the left deviationists, gave up on liberty and embraced state power and can't resist trying to just use it to bludgeon their opponents into the ground. And they've led us to this, where now we have a $30 trillion debt and a $5 trillion a year government that is driving our society into the ground.
Absolutely. So we started, so you mentioned the plumb line there. So we started, or America at least started as, you know, this dream. And I actually have to submit my bloody article to Libertarian Institute where I kind of follow that journey. But we started from the premise of the libertarian, and then we've sort of deviated. And then, you know, people like Rothbard emerged to remind people, hey, you know, this is the plumb line. And, you know, then we've sort of, I don't know, it felt like there was like a bit of a resurgence 50, 60 years ago towards the libertarian ideal. I could be wrong. I wasn't around back then, but it feels like there was something in the air. But we seem to have deviated so far further again. Like, you know, the state has never been bigger. You know, there's never been this much. Well, I could be wrong again because I'm only 33, but, you know, I haven't sensed, at least in my lifetime, so much, like such a largesse by the state, and such a blame to the other side. Like, you know, I haven't seen so much infighting. So are we libertarians today, using whether it's the Scott Horton method or the fuck you method or whatever it is, are we bringing people back towards the plumb line? Do you think we're winning in some way here? You know, are we gaining ground again? Or do you think at this point it's, you know, or is it hopeless at the moment? Like, are we not getting through to anyone? Like, is everyone too fucking caught up fighting about whether they're wearing one, two, or three masks? Like, where do you think we're at? Yeah.
Well, you know, I don't know, man. I guess it depends if we measure in total population or per capita or what, right? Like, you got to admit, there's never been as many libertarians as this, you know, ever. And and in terms of population percentages and all that, too. And all hail Ron Paul for this, for his presidential runs in 08 and 2012. In both cases, those campaigns were essentially these massive speaking tours on behalf of peace and liberty and showing people that you don't have to fall into these, you know, categories where if you believe in this, you have to believe in that too. It just ain't right. You know, look at me. I believe in this, this, and that. And it was perfect. It's exactly what millions of people were dying to hear. And now, as opposed to the year 2007, my friend, now they have to deal with the libertarian side of almost everything. They have to at least mock us and say, oh yeah, sure, the LOL libertarians think this or that or whatever it is. We didn't have a voice that was even worth considering to dismiss on in any kind of national debate whatsoever. The so-called tables, just the right and the left, that's it. And so, I mean, the fact is, like I say, I was, when I saw that bumper sticker, I must have been 19, 20 years. No. I must have been in high school, I guess. I was 16, 15, 16, 17 years old, something like that, before I even saw that sticker that said, enough is enough, vote libertarian. I'd never heard of such a thing. And then from there, I had to go to the Access Channel, you know, to try to find out anything about it. Now it's the days of the internet where anybody can go to Mises.org and read 100,000 pages of Austrian school economics and Rothbardian revisionist everything. And so, you know, no, man, I think, yeah, I mean, times are changing, right? We're going through a change of eras right now where Donald Trump, especially after being unelected after 4 years, really puts a capstone and an ending kind of stopper on the Bush Obama era of the first 20 years of this century. And now it's kind of a big odometer effect, sort of a turning point into this new decade and this new kind of era. And you got old libertarians are dying and retiring, and new and younger voices are rising up and becoming great writers and, you know, doing all kinds of new things. And so it's in flux for sure. But, you know, it's a kind of contradictory sort of a thing. You know, we're very much pushing a boulder uphill, but we're also like deliberately refusing to use force to push the boulder uphill at the same time too, right? So we're not in a very good position to, you know, apply political pressure because we eschew political power, you know? So the best thing that most of us can do is, certainly my best idea is, just denounce everything all the time the best I can. Try to get people to suspend their presumption of legitimacy of this system and the way things are set up. But I certainly don't seek power. I don't think you see yourself on a track to become a senator one day or something like that. And because you're libertarian, that's not your interest, right? Your disinterest flows from the fact that you do believe in liberty. And if you and if you really wanted to be a senator, you'd have to stop believing in liberty to be one, you know, pretty much. So, you know, this is kind of the story of the neocons too. It's funny, you know, the neocons and the libertarians in like the 60s and 70s, they're all kind of cousins, right? And they all oppose the new left together, but the neocons are the cult of power. And the libertarians are the cult of screw this, I'm moving to Alabama just so I'm not even tempted to have any power, you know? Guess who took control of the Bush Jr. administration and killed a million people? Not the libertarians. You know, it was the guys who decided that no matter what, I'm dedicating my life to being the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy if I can do it. And they did it.
Yeah. So it's very Nietzschean in a way, because it's like, I think that analogy you used, which is, you know, we as libertarians sort of, you know, we live by this idea of the renunciation of power, which is in a way why it's not as enticing as trying to be on the left or the right, because, you know, the left, like you just want to win. So it's like, fuck it. I'll just go to, because libertarianism is literally about saying that I don't want the power versus right. One of these sides. Yeah, that's a really interesting thing. So
don't tread on anyone.
I guess. Yeah. It's, so, and this is actually why, I guess libertarians by nature are, you know, much more, I guess, in some ways, you know, full of guile and wit and intelligence and everything. But at the same time, I feel like a lot of libertarians suffer almost from, I call it, you know, like battered woman syndrome. Is they, we've been banging this fucking drum for so long, and it's like, it just feels so hopeless, because, you know, it's like, you know, we're kind of the people who are watching everyone drown, and like, no, you're drowning yourself and you're bringing everyone else down. But people just seem to keep doing the same fucking thing. Yeah. But this brings me to part of the conversation that I wanted to dig into here, which is Bitcoin specifically. So you, from the little you know about me, you know that I'm, you know, a Bitcoiner. And for me, my path into libertarianism was, I guess, you know, long before I discovered Bitcoin, I've always been an entrepreneur. You know, I dropped out of university and I kind of built my own businesses, and I got ripped off by the government and some stuff. So I had an organic distaste for government when I was younger. I've always, you know, been self-sufficient. I've always done my own thing. So I had this tendency to be libertarian anyway, but I never, kind of similar to you, I hadn't seen the bumper badge until I sort of stumbled into Bitcoin and I started understanding that, hey, here's this form of money which is non-state money. I also did sort of in 2011, 2012, actually, I must admit, I came across the whole hard money concept and you know, gold, silver, and back when I think Gerald Celente and Mark Faber and all of those guys were around, you know, screaming about the TSA and about the first round of QE after 2008. Mm-hmm. But for me, I guess Bitcoin represents such a powerful solution. So I guess as libertarians, you know, one of the best things we can do, and I think Dave Smith does this well, is like make fun of the establishment, point out the inconsistencies, you know, of what they're doing. You know, then there's the Scott Horton method, which is, you know, align with them and then bring them along and try and help them, you know, admit to their own inconsistencies. But as a tool of peaceful warfare, I haven't come across anything as powerful as Bitcoin as a solution. And I guess the two questions here is, you know, I'm curious as to why more libertarians aren't as sold on Bitcoin. You know, is it a lack of understanding it, perhaps? Is it a fuck, I've seen too many of these potential solutions that have sort of fizzled out. So I'm curious on that. And I'd be curious to sort of get your understanding of how you perceive Bitcoin in the grand scheme of things. And then I'd like to sort of dig into that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would certainly like to see all of human society adopt whatever kind of currencies they can to make governments obsolete. You know, I hate government and undermining their power and authority. Is I'm all for that. I don't know if Bitcoin can really do that or not. If it gives some people the ability to opt out of state systems and avoid having to pay all the fines and fees and taxes and all the things, and they can find a way to use Bitcoin to have essentially an underground economy out, you know, outside of the view of the state, keep each other paid and taken care of without having to submit to their power, even just on the margin, then that's wonderful. You know, if that doesn't, whether or not that really pressures the system, that's still great. You know, I'm all for that. I personally would be more into Bitcoin, except that I don't ever have any money because I just work for peanuts for nonprofits to do this anti-war stuff. That's basically my thing. And so I've had Bitcoins in the past, but I always had to sell them all to pay the rent or take care of my wife's medical bills or whatever it is. I actually had about a couple of $10,000 worth of them last fall that I had to sell right before the giant bubble, you know, or boom went back up. So I definitely lost out on that, but my attitude is always just easy come, easy go as far as all that goes. And also I'm no kind of computer genius. So I always need my computer genius's help with all the passwords and seeds and codes and wallets and crap. You know, I'm barely able to do any of that myself. So I think that's probably speaking for some others too. That makes it a little bit more difficult when, you know, where's that piece of paper with my code, passcode on it and whatever, just makes it kind of difficult for people. And also the constantly fluctuating price, I think makes it seem like, well, and not just constantly fluctuating, but usually going up and up and up. And so then it's like Say's law, or not Say's, whose law is it, where the good money chases out the bad? Where so instead of spending Bitcoin, people would rather invest in Bitcoin and spend dollars because they're depreciating faster. And so that seems to kind of short circuit some use of it as an actual currency and more of just, you know, as a commodity itself that people are investing in to save in. But I'm no expert on all that stuff. I mean, I have nothing but positive, you know, encouraging things for all of you guys who know what you're doing. And by the way, if you hate paying the IRS capital gains taxes and stuff like that, the Libertarian Institute is a 501c3. So that's for all your Bitcoiners in the audience here.
Well, let's dig into one of those things. So I guess I want to dig into a few of those things because I think your audience and libertarians all around would really benefit from understanding, you know, Bitcoin's importance as something that fundamentally defunds the state. So, you know, my contention, and I was on a podcast the other day talking about how the strongest tool that the government, or let's not even say the government, the state has, is the ability to produce money, you know, and money is the resource through which human beings are able to collaborate, through which, you know, everything is able to be done. You can't do shit without some sort of mechanism to measure value and to maneuver and shift and send value in different places. Like that is the game here. So by being able to print the shit, not just tax it from your constituents, you're able to run effectively a bankrupt enterprise. You're able to run an empire, which is effectively what the government is. It's like you said, it's $30 trillion in debt. That number is not going to get lower. I don't care whether it's a conservative, a Dem, or whoever the fuck decides to get in power. That's not going to go down. The system is geared in such a way that the debt is going to continue to increase, because the parasite that is the state needs to continue to grow. Like, you know, that is the track, that's the train track that we're on. So for me, and for a lot of Bitcoiners and stuff like that, is, you know, we're not looking at Bitcoin as an investment. We're looking at it as a economic force. So like you kind of pointed out to the drug war, right? No matter how much a central authority tries to stamp out something like drugs, the economic reality of supply and demand is such that it'll always emerge and it'll only get stronger the more they sort of push against it. And Bitcoin sort of represents this, but in a monetary sense, which is this, it's almost like a black hole of economic gravity that no matter how much the government sort of pushes against it, because it is, you know, has these key attributes, which is it's fixed in supply. So it performs the store of value function of money very well. It is an uncensorable mechanism for payment, meaning it performs the medium of exchange function perfectly well. And it is, we know how much there is, and we can, it's perfectly divisible. It can perform the unit of account function of money very well. So we've got this perfect money almost. As more people want to hold it, as opposed to holding fraudulent government money, which is effectively what the IOUs from the Federal Reserve are, or from any other fucking state for that matter. As we do that, we actually build its economic mass. And as its economic mass builds, it actually attracts more people to say, what the fuck am I doing in diminishing fiat currency? I should go over here. And that, to me, represents a runaway train and, you know, this sort of self-reinforcing feedback loop that at this point in time is impossible to stop. Maybe 5 years ago, the state had an opportunity to potentially stop it or do something about it. But the fact that, you know, Bitcoin's almost compressing, like we look at gold and over 5,000 years, it emerged as a monetary unit, right? It, you know, at the beginning, maybe, you know, if we could have gone back 5,000 years ago and everyone was still using seashells and salt, someone could have found a gold nugget and tried to trade it for a chicken and got laughed at because it's like, what the hell am I going to do with this gold thing? You know, it's like, it's, you know, I can't eat it. I can't drink it. I can't wear it. So fuck off. But over time, as more and more people converged onto gold because of the properties that it had, because it represented this metaphysical concept of money better, you know, the big nugget of gold that you found that was originally worthless, all of a sudden could buy an entire kingdom. And I believe Bitcoin's taking that 5,000 years of gold and compressing it into what might be a couple of decades, because economic Darwinism is real. Like you know, an analogy I'll use is this idea of don't tell me what you believe. Show me your bank account and I'll tell you what you believe. Because our human action is actually a representation of what we actually believe and who we are and what we think and do, right? It's not what we just say out of our mouth. It's actually human action praxeology is where, you know, our beliefs are actually discovered. So economic Darwinism would suggest that in order for me to maintain my purchasing power, I'm not going to go and work for a year or a week or any time. And if someone's going to promise me payment in salt, you know, or in tissues, I'm not going to accept that. I'm going to accept the best form of money. And like you sort of said, Gresham's law is that good money pushes out bad money. So more and more people are going to wake up to the economic reality that the best place to store their wealth is Bitcoin. And the fact that it is outside of government control. And as Hayek said, you know, I don't believe we'll ever have a good money until we, in a sly roundabout way, pull it out of, get it away from the government. That's what Bitcoin has done. And it's going to continue spiraling and strengthening. And in the process, defund the very institutions that enable things like a monopoly on violence, a monopoly on morality, a monopoly on ethics, a monopoly on, you know, regulation, and all the other shit that the state does. So I guess, you know, for me, I don't see, you know, Bitcoin has to be volatile at the moment because it's got to emerge. Like it's starting from nothing. Like it's a pure market driven money. Like fiat money would be, you know, fiat money is something that is decreed and told to us, this is the value of it. No one's telling us what Bitcoin is. Bitcoin is emerging as a market good, which is how a natural, organic, free market money has to emerge. So it's doing its job. And we just happen to be in the early stages of it. We're 10 years into something which has traditionally, you know, the last hard money that we had took 5,000 years to emerge. You know, if Bitcoin does it in 50 years, that's still fucking monumental. But we just happen to be at the very early stage of this. So I guess I would really love to, I don't know, I think it's such an, a powerful message, because unless we demonopolize money, unless we remove the capacity for the state to fund itself to run a bankrupt organization through which it can bomb and pillage and run a fucking empire, no matter what we say, no matter how many books we've written, no matter how many people we try and like convert into thinking more consistently, the tendency is always going to be back towards trying to amass power via the state, because the state can produce its own money. And this is why I think, you know, the libertarian cause, I did a talk in Vienna actually a year and a bit ago where I said Austrian economics and libertarianism is impossible without Bitcoin, because all we're going to be doing is talking and talking and talking, because we don't hold, like you said earlier, we're trying to push this boulder uphill without using force. Like the tendency for everyone else is always going to be to go right or left or go political because they can obtain power in some way. Whereas now we've actually got a peaceful tool to actually eliminate their power and bankrupt them. So do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, that all sounds great. I'm not, you know, personally, I'm not convinced that Bitcoin can replace US dollars in the market, in the country or the world. But at the same time, I'm the first one to tell you, I think I already said, I know very little about it. It has not been my area of interest and expertise. It all sounds fine to me. And like I said, any opting out that anybody's doing on the path from here to there is all progress as far as I'm concerned. As, you know, if you can really do it like you're saying, prove in the marketplace that this is a better way to go, where people will really, you know, kind of en masse switch, like from MySpace to Facebook, and just switch from dollars to Bitcoins kind of all at once, you know, when critical mass day comes or whatever. I'd love to see it, man. You know, the worst thing that ever happened in this country was the, you know, Constitutional Convention created the Congress. And then after that was the Congress passed the Federal Reserve Act. And from there, that's their blank check to do whatever they want. And they killed, well, you know, nobody knows how many tens of millions of people they've killed with the money they've printed since 1914, you know?
Well, here's my question to you is, how do we get you and people like you who've got a voice more interested? Because again, I am personally adamant that this is a more powerful tool than anything else we're doing. Like, you know, because I know how hard you work. You're one of the hardest workers in the space. And, you know, you're out there educating people on, you know, the atrocities that, you know, perpetrated by the US government and other statists. How do we, you know, get you to better understand Bitcoin? Because that is a more powerful tool than anything else that we're all doing combined. Like, it is
right for the bankrupting them. I mean, that's, I guess that's one of my cheats, right? I don't have to write great articles on everything. I just have to publish them, because I run the Libertarian Institute. And so, you know, we've run plenty of great articles on Bitcoin. We've got some stuff on the blog right now on Bitcoin, and some guy was calling it a Ponzi scheme and some other guy was arguing why, no, it's actually not. And here's what you need to know about it and all that. So that's at the Libertarian Institute right now. And, you know, I mean, honestly, man, it's just a matter of, you know, division of responsibility and that kind of deal. What's the term I'm thinking of? You know, like comparative advantage labor in the marketplace. You know, like my advantage is remembering what Bush did to Iraq, and then other people's advantage is doing math and remembering their cloud seed, you know?
I appreciate that. I think, look, that those sort of technical issues, like remembering your seed and all that sort of stuff, that's all what I would say user experience stuff. Like, you know, I have a tech company, and, you know, what we do is we enable people to easily accumulate Bitcoin without having to remember their seeds. So I think that's all more user experience stuff. I guess what I'm more interested in is how do we get this message to more people, which is the simplest act of protest you can make against the state.
I think it's already working, right? I think as you're kind of explaining there, Bitcoin speaks for itself, man, right? It's either working or it doesn't. It's almost, you know, it's the perfect experiment in the sense that, you know, the price is right there all the way down to 10 decimal places or whatever it is, right, at any given instant. And so the proof is always in the pudding in real time. And so I think people don't have to have an ideology at all, right? People can just be some guy from the neighborhood. And, man, you know what I need to do is get in this Bitcoin stuff. And that's just because that it proves its own case and that, you know, it maintains its value or better and is reliable, and everybody's cousin's using it. And so now they are too, because it just kind of gets to that critical mass. I'm sure you probably remember in 2008 when everyone, right, like the whole society switched from MySpace to Facebook in the space of like 4 weeks. Because for whatever reason, MySpace wouldn't quit with the static background and then the text scrolling over it. And it was impossible to read the damn page. And so everybody just switched to nice, clean blue and white, you know, simple as that. And so I think I'm sure, look, if I am you, then I just think that day's coming, right? And if I'm me, I have no reason to disagree with you, man. I just don't know enough about it myself, but I don't know why that shouldn't be the case. I know that, I mean, look at the US dollar right now. People are fleeing the US dollar for whatever they can. And it's only just beginning, correct, right?
So to those two points, I would, I guess, for the benefit of yourself and potentially the listeners here, is like the Facebook MySpace analogy is good, because it sort of shows how quickly network effects can sort of root themselves when you have a much better experience, which, you know, Bitcoin represents a much better experience. If we think about what money is supposed to do, it's supposed to store value, supposed to be a medium exchange, and supposed to be a unit of account so you can measure other goods and services with it. Well, the thing that we've got that's supposedly the best is the US dollar. It doesn't store value very well. It's, you know, if we believe the bullshit CPI numbers, we're losing 3% per annum. But in reality, if we measure it against the rising price of assets, we're more like losing 15% of our value every single year. So it's pathetic at the store value function. The medium exchange function is crap, because if you want to send US dollars internationally, you get basically raped by SWIFT, or you get told who and where you can send it to by our, you know, overlords. And that's only going to get worse as they roll out these central bank digital currencies, where the Fed is directly going to fund your account and then decide, Mr. Scott Horton, what you can and cannot spend your money on. And if you have said something untoward on social media, maybe we'll turn off your capacity to use your own money, like they're doing in China, etc. So it doesn't perform that fucking function. And then the third function of you know, measuring other goods and services, it's doing that okay, but, you know, as it loses its purchasing power, it starts to become a poorer use in that third function of money, which is probably the least. It's the function that comes last in the maturation of money, and this is where that is happening in real time. So taking the Facebook MySpace analogy, is like Bitcoin is money that actually works. You can't debase it, you can't print it, so it's the best store of value on the planet. You can't censor it, so nobody can control where and when and what time and how much and who you can send it to. So it's perfectly uncensorable money. And, you know, when, as it matures enough, we'll be able to start measuring all other goods and services. And so I think, you know, it's kind of the MySpace Facebook transition, but multiplied by a million, because we didn't have a pain point to just move from MySpace to Facebook other than like some bad UX. Whereas we have real pain coming in the real world to move to a better money. Like, you know, if your money is evaporating in your very hands, and you're starting to be told what you can and cannot spend your money on, perhaps based on your opinion or your skin color or whatever the fuck is coming down the road, the incentive to get the hell out of that into something better is real. And what are the options people have? Are they going to go to fucking Chinese renminbi? Are they going to go to the euro? No. You know, they're going to go to perhaps gold, but gold is not very easy to send around the world, and it's very hard to store. So the only real option is Bitcoin. And this is why I think it's such an important thing. And that necessity is actually going to drive Bitcoin's strength, economically speaking, which is what then feeds back into defunding the state. So anyway, I feel like I've banged on about that enough now, but I just, I will definitely do some pieces for Libertarian Institute, but I would implore you, because I just think you've got such a great platform and so you've done such great work that I would my invitation is to implore you to, you know, look a little bit further into this, and not the technicality of it. Like, I'm not a specifically technical person. I'm technically capable enough to, you know, work in and around Bitcoin, but I understand it from a philosophy standpoint, which I think will align really well with you. And I just think it's the rock in the slingshot that, you know, we're the Davids and we can actually hit the Goliath right in the eye with this one. Yeah. Whereas
I'll tell you what, man, when it first came out in at the end of 08, very beginning of 2009 is when I moved to LA. And I remember when Bitcoin was trading at 0.000002 something. And I remember thinking, meh, how much is that ever going to be worth? And also, yeah, they tried that with e-gold and it didn't last. Mm-hmm. And so who knows? It's one gimmick after another with these guys or whatever. But if I just bought $100 worth of them, then I'd be living in a palace now. Actually, I wouldn't. But I'd have a ramp in the backyard and I would have, you know, a truck that's probably a little newer than 25 years old. but yeah, no, nah, man, I'm happy for everybody who's made their killing in Bitcoin. I know a lot of people have, and I agree with you that, you know, it would be nice to do the Hayekian thing where even if they don't legalize it, just technology and culture end up making government money obsolete and find a way. I mean, after all, it's not like we can vote them out of power. It's not like we can pressure them into peace. Not really. So if there's a way to truly undercut them, then let's do it, you know?
We can bankrupt them, and that's our only thing. So like, and the thing is, it gets so messy in this space. Like, I'm always hearing all these shit coiners and, you know, Bcashers and this and that, all these other idiots who are all trying to, like, you know, reinvent existing, you know, traditional financial infrastructure and begging the government for permission. Oh, let us, you know, do our fucking new app. It's like, it's so pathetic. Whereas like, we are actually seeing the emergence of that Hayekian money that is, you know, outside of state control, is incorruptible. It basically demonopolizes money. By demonopolizing money, we can't, none of us, not you, not me, not anybody, can get an advantage over other people. And that kind of starts to re-equilibrate, that's even a word, society organically. Like, you know, we start to have a basis upon which we can build free markets. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, more than just, also to your point about, you know, people making a killing and getting rich, like, I think people come into Bitcoin, I have a saying, which is, I came into Bitcoin for the money, but I stayed for the money. And what I mean by that is, like, I came to get rich, but I couldn't give a shit. Like, I live like a pauper. I live at the base of my means. I could not care less about how rich I am in dollar terms, because that doesn't matter to me. All I actually care about is I'm here for the movement. I'm here to help spread this idea and say, look, people, wake the fuck up. There is something wrong here, and we're playing a rigged game. We are playing a fundamentally rigged game where if you and I say something, we're terrorists or we're bigots or we're racist or we're whatever the fuck label they want to give us. But, you know, or we get into a scuffle, we should go to jail. But these idiots, they get to create their own money. They get to fund themselves. They get to bomb everyone. They get to imprison us. They get to steal our money. And the longer we play into their game, the more we support them. So like, for me, I always call it a moral duty to get the fuck out of government currency. Like, any of us that are still here as libertarians, still holding US dollars or, you know, any other government funny money, we're supporting these idiots. And that's why, like, I feel like it's such an important point to make for people. It's like, we have got to stop supporting the jailers that are imprisoning us and then complaining that they're imprisoning us, because we're doing it to ourselves.
Yeah, I'm with you. But just like I say, though, I mean, I don't have any money that I'm holding in dollars. All my money goes to the bills. So, in fact, you know, I'm a deadbeat when it comes to my wife's medical bills. I pay about a third of them, I guess. And the rest just go to some poor bankrupt collector. But everybody, every libertarian who has money, by all means, put it in Bitcoin, you know.
I'm sorry to hear that, man. I hope there's a way that we can, you know, maybe, I don't know, help you like sort of build savings, because, you know, I guess savings is the cornerstone of civilization anyway. It's the cornerstone of, you know, any human being's capacity to plan for the future. So, you know, I genuinely do hope that, you know, you can get over the humps that you might be experiencing now. And I hope the book does fucking well, so that way you can take some of, you know, that.
I'll tell you, I mean, in a week or two, we're going to be doing a big fund drive at the Institute. I have to wait until I get enough books. I got, you know, hundreds of books coming, but they come slow. But once I have enough books, I can take care of my previous donors and the people who helped me with the book. Then after that, we're going to do a big fundraiser at the Libertarian Institute. And we absolutely have a Bitcoin address there at libertarianinstitute.org/donate. And, you know, it ain't just me. It's the great Sheldon Richman. And of course, Pete Quinones and Kyle Anzalone and a great bunch of podcasters and writers on all kinds of issues and everything. I'm really proud of the Institute. I think, you know, I'm ashamed that I haven't been able to put as much work into running it lately because I've been working so hard on the book. But there's a lot there for everybody. So
the work you guys are doing is incredible. I'm going to add that now to the, I will add that, sorry, when I put the show live, because I want people to, you know, if anyone listening to this, you know, wants to sort of help out here, I think that's this is one institution that really is, that deserves help, is because you guys are like, you know, I kind of, whilst I envision Bitcoin as like the silver bullet that defunds the state, like, it can't do it in isolation. You know, we have to still do all of the other work, which is keep, you know, doing the work that the Libertarian Institute's doing, keep producing content, keep holding people accountable, keep, you know, making comedy, like whatever we're doing across all these fronts is incredibly important, because we need to take a silver bullet and a lead bullet strategy to bringing down the Goliath that is the state. Otherwise, we're never going to, I mean, technologically speaking, these idiots are so powerful now that they can either, you know, basically jail us all in some sort of Brave New World version of the future, or could be dumb enough to blow us all up because they're so fucking, you know, insanely power hungry and deranged in the head. So like, we have to bring them down. Otherwise we're, the future and, you know, our children's future is genuinely in jeopardy.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And, you know, it is a funny paradox of our movement too, that it's just the way things are set up in this country, is that the Libertarian Institute and antiwar.com, and of course, for that matter, Mises and FFF and Cato and Independent Institute, we're all nonprofit organizations that rely on the donations of our readers and consumers of our content. So unlike any other business where you just charge a price for whatever you're doing, we give all our stuff away and then depend on the kindness of strangers, which is a pretty funny way for a bunch of Austrians to do business. But that's the way things are set up here. So that's how it goes.
We need more libertarian entrepreneurs, because we need to figure out how to monetize some of this stuff. But look, Scott, do you have any final closing thoughts? I wanted to do my best to sort of, like, I don't know, nudge you along the Bitcoin path. Maybe the seeds I've planted, you know, might inspire you to look a little bit deeper. I know you've been really busy with the book. You know,
in fact, I should tell you, I have a friend of mine who's an old friend from a very long time ago, who's very much into this stuff, and who I talked to a few weeks ago, and we were talking about doing a project, and he was going to kind of take the lead of being, you know, maybe bring him even on to the Institute to kind of lead our Bitcoin type efforts and this kind of thing. So I can't say there's definitely a project in the works there, but there's a potential project in the works there to create, you know, even a whole part of the Institute that's dedicated to cryptocurrency stuff and all the rest of that. And cool. He sounds a lot like you. He's very evangelical about it.
Look, slowly by slowly, your same name we too. Will get... Oh, really?
Yeah. Huh, yeah, his name is Alex. He's an old friend. I've known him since he was 10 and I was 13 at the skate park.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. I wonder if I'd know him. Is he on Twitter or?
Yeah, but I think not very much.
Yeah,
anyway,
okay.
Let's talk about that.
Maybe we've crossed paths. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
for
definitely.
Sure, for sure. All right, Scott. So thank you again for jumping on this episode, man. And thank you for letting me also rant backwards about some Bitcoin stuff.
Yeah. I really, and everybody buy my book, Enough Already. It's about all the wars since 79. You'll hate it.
That's the best plug ever. All right, Scott. Thanks, buddy.
All right. Thank you, man. Appreciate it.